So we're already 12 minutes into the webinar, and I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Jeff Armstrong with Orange County Sanitation District, Fountain Valley, California. Our second speaker will be Marsha Black, University of Georgia, Athens, Georgia. Jeff's title is From Treatment Plants to Turbots, Data Suggesting Effects from Endocrine Disruptive Chemicals in Wastewater Discharges into the Pacific Ocean. I would like to remind you again, please mute your phones, star six to mute, and please do not put us on hold. And Jeff?
Yes.
If you're ready, please start.
All right, thank you very much. One thing I'd like to point out in the title, From Treatment Plants to Turbots, I think the treatment plant is pretty self-evident of who we are, although I'll get into that also. But turbots, for those of you who may not know, that's a flatfish, and you'll be seeing pictures of them, and I'll be talking more about them. But that implies my background, which is not toxicology. It is not chemistry. I am a biological oceanographer, a marine biologist, if you will. But this is really some really interesting stuff, and I'm really glad I got into it, and it's kind of what makes science worthwhile. And just kind of an aside, the way a marine biologist gets into working on these issues, I'm senior scientist here in the Ocean Monitoring Program, and a while back our toxicologist decided to retire, and when they needed to fill the position, they lined us all up and asked us to spell environmental toxicology, and I was the first one that could do it without having to write it down or ask it to be used in a sentence, so I got the job. And so from that, it led into these really neat studies that we've been doing with a lot of very interesting people. And I hope you find it interesting today. If you go to the next slide, slide two, just who we are, Orange County Sanitation District. We are the third largest wastewater treatment district or publicly owned treatment works west of the Mississippi River. L.A. County and L.A. City beat us out, but those are the only two. We service a 470-mile square mile service area, about 2.5 million people, and we treat about 243 million gallons of 80% industrial, or correction, 80% residential and 20% industrial effluent per day. In addition to that, we disinfect with hypochlorite bleach, and then we dechlorinate that with sodium bisulfite, which adds some more chemicals to the mix. We are not a full secondary treatment plant. Right now we're doing about 70% secondary, 30% primary. We're on our way to full secondary, but we won't be there till about the year 2012. We've been operating under a 301H permit for a number of years now. Slide three is advancing slowly for me. That's just a map of where we are, service area. We're located in Fountain Valley, Plant 1, and then Plant 2 is at Huntington Beach, Surf City, USA. You may remember a few years ago when the beach was shut down all summer because of bacterial contamination, and we've been working on that. That's sort of that and Disneyland are the two big markers. Disneyland's up the Santa Ana River about 10 miles. And then Newport Bay, and you can see our pipeline's coming out. We have two, one short outfall, and the short one comes out about a mile. We do not use that. That's for emergency purposes only, and we haven't had to use that since 1971. Until recently, when we had about 12 MGDs had to go out because of some repairs we were doing. And then we have our nominal outfall, which is the 1 mile long diffuser. Discharges about 200 feet, 4.5 miles out, via 500 ports that are about 6 to 8 inches in diameter. And then the next slide, maybe slide four, our ocean monitoring program. It's a tri-phase monitoring program. We have the core monitoring, which is pretty self-evident. It's just the stuff we do day in, day out, compliance monitoring. Regional monitoring is something we do every 5 years. It's coordinated by the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, or SCWRP, and that's something we do with all the POTWs, universities, anyone who wants to be involved. NGOs are involved in this. It's really a great project. And there we take a synoptic look from point conception up near Santa Barbara all the way down to the U.S.-Mexico international border. Generally about 300 stations will look at all the things that the core monitoring looks at, fish, invertebrates, sediment geochemistry. We get a synoptic look of the entire Southern California Bight in about a two-month time frame. and then strategic process studies. And that's where today my talk falls into, is the strategic process studies. And if you advance to the next slide, you'll see what they are is these are required in our permit, and it requires us to do a certain level of effort, which is not defined, but is agreed upon year to year by our agency and regulators. The purposes are to answer questions raised by the core monitoring that the core monitoring just doesn't address, obviously, and then other areas of concern and issues that may arise. For example, we're looking at current mapping by deploying sensors out there in the marine environment, sediment toxicity, and endocrine disrupting chemicals and contaminants of emerging concern. We became involved in this in about 1999, and through a series of pilot projects with university and other researchers, and now it's led into a lot of grant-funded research. And the next slide, research projects. How do we do this? We're not a research agency. We're a public agency. We're a monitoring agency, or actually we're a monitoring group within a public agency with wastewater treatment. And so we have three main strategies that we've come up with. One are in-house projects. What we have expertise in doing, we do. We hire contractors when necessary. And the last is collaborations with university researchers and others who have the expertise, and they bring that to the table, and then what we bring to the table is on the next slide. So what we provide is the ecological expertise. We're out there monitoring in the ocean environment off the coast of Orange County virtually every day. We know more about that area than anybody else. In-kind services, we have our own research vessel, we have crew, supplies for field collection, and I found over the past few years that that seems to be the limiting factor for a lot of university researchers is access to a vessel and collection, and so we provide that. And then funding of grad students. We have now funded two PhD students and several master's students working on projects related to CECs, endocrine disruptors, and other ecological areas. The next slide. First of all, I want to give credit where credit is due. As I said, I'm not a toxicologist. I am not a chemist. I am a biologist working in a monitoring program, although I'm learning a lot about both of those, and I more than I ever thought I would. But I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, or if they're not giants, they're at least very, very tall people. And we could not get the answers to these questions that we're interested in without them. First of all, the things I'm going to talk about today is cortisol inhibition, and that's done via Kevin Kelly. He's a professor of endocrinology at Cal State University Long Beach. Estrogenicity through Dan Schlink's lab at UC Riverside. Sperm DNA damage, Scott Steinert at Computer Sciences Corporation in San Diego, which is attached to the Navy SPAWARS program down there. And the new thing, for those of you who might have heard me talk at Las Vegas last August, a year ago August, we've been looking at correlation of parasites in fishes to cortisol inhibition, which was one of our graduate students funding at UCLA, actually, although she's now a postdoc in the Kelly Lab at Cal State Long Beach. So that's the areas that I'm going to touch on today, and those are the people who are doing the real hardcore work on this. I will not be able to answer questions later about how the ELISAs were done or any of that. You'll have to refer to the Kevin Kelly, Dan Schlink, and others on that. But these are the results that we've come up with is what I'm going to talk about. And first, our study area. Another picture of our study area. If you have the PowerPoint slides up, you'll need to click a couple of times. If you have the PDF version, then you get them all at one time. But you'll see on the large outfall coming out, if you press the button once, if you have the PowerPoint, a circle will come up and circle station T1. That is our outfall station. And then if you press it again, a circle will come up and stay in circle station T11. That is our quote-unquote reference station. I say quote-unquote because we really don't have a true reference area in our monitoring area, or really it's hard to find one in Southern California. There's just too much urbanization, too much industrialization, We cannot find an area that is free of contamination, as you can imagine. So we call that our far field, or for lack of a better term, I'll just call it a reference area for the purposes of this talk. It's the cleanest thing we have. So a lot of our results are just correlating T1 to T11. But if you look to the right of that, and there will be no circle around this one, you'll see a red dot about the same distance to the right as T11 is to the left of T1. That's station T3. That's sort of a downcoast reference, downcoast far field station, which we used in one of the studies. And so it's about 5.5 kilometers downcoast from T1, and T11 is 7.7 kilometers upcoast of T1. So they're a fair distance away. The next slide, which doesn't seem to be coming up for me. Okay, next slide is showing cortisol production. Cortisol is produced by the hypothalamal pituitary interrenal axis, one of the things I learned from Kevin Kelly, and which I'm going to show in just a minute how that kind of works. It's inhibited by chronic stress. And so chronic stress can come from a number of areas. One of the hypothesized stressors here are pharmaceuticals, personal care products, and endocrine disruptors and other chemicals of concern. This next one is, if you have the PowerPoint, you'll need to click it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times to get the full screen up. But basically it shows that you have a stressor, handling of the fish in the net, crowding in captivity in an aquarium, or pollutants, showing an end-of-the-pipe discharge there. It stimulates the HPI axis. That leads to elevated cortisol levels, or at least it should lead to elevated cortisol levels. In humans, the best analogy would be when we were all back in school, and generally around finals time, you got a cold. Well, you got a cold because of the elevated cortisol levels, because of the effects of that cortisol on your stress system. Which, what you have on the system, the elevated cortisol levels produce an increase in catabolic pathways, glucose, hepatic glucose production, amino acid release from muscles, lipid breakdown. Basically, you have an increased fuel source to fight whatever stressor it is that you're dealing with. But it comes with an anabolic cost, and you have a breakdown in growth and repair. It affects your reproductive system and immune functions, because those are very energy expensive processes in the body, and the energy is now being diverted to fight the stressor. So if you go to the next slide, which now is a figure showing peak cortisol concentrations in post-trawl flatfish. One of the things you need to note on this is that from the time that a fish is stressed until we can measure cortisol in the cortisol surge that we should see is about 10 minutes. From the time that a fish is caught in our net, even if it's caught at the very last part of the, before we trawl it up and bring it on deck, it's probably a good 15 to 20 minutes before we're measuring the cortisol in the fish, before we're drawing the blood. So it's definitely, if there's a cortisol surge, we're going to see it. We won't miss it because of timing. Direct you on this first to the right side of the slide, an English sole, which is a flatfish, and what you'll see is the reference site, the concentration of cortisol is fairly large, and that's what you expect to see in a reference site, at a fish at a reference site. And then you look at the outfall, and the cortisol production is about half. So there's something that is stressing the fish chronically at the outfall that is keeping the cortisol from being expressed to the level that it should be. Now, if you look at the horny-head turbot to the left, you'll see that the reference site actually is expressing less cortisol than the outfall, but both fish are expressing much less cortisol than the English sole. We don't know why. We're working on that, but there's something going on with horny-head turbot in particular that is all askew. And the fact that the reference site had less cortisol production than the outfall is counterintuitive, and we're still working on that. And the next slide shows peak cortisol and horny-head turbot from different locales throughout Southern California, just to put our area into context. Santa Monica Bay, which is where the L.A. Hyperion, L.A. City Hyperion outfall discharges into, And you can see that we're comparable to them in these fish. But then go look at San Diego. Now, San Diego discharges about 100 MGD less than we do, about 200 MGD less than L.A., but they're discharging primary treated effluent only, and yet they still have what would be a more normal cortisol surge. What the difference, or why the similarities in us and L.A., again, we're looking into that in a much larger project that I'll speak on later. The next slide, insulin-like growth factor. Now, these cortisol and insulin-like growth factor are being done in the Kelly Lab at Cal State Long Beach, and IGF-1 mediates the effect of growth hormone and is depressed by cortisol surges. So when you have cortisol being constantly expressed, you're also going to have a depression in insulin-like growth factor. And so this would be depressed in stressed fish. That's what we would expect. And the next slide shows a figure of these concentrations in the fish. And again, you can see the English sole. That's about what we would expect in a fish. Again, something stressing them at the outfall, just like the cortisol. So that's intuitive. Horny-head turbot, though, again, much less expression than we would expect, and even in a stressed fish, and equal. There's no difference between outfall and reference. So there's something going on with these fish. There's also something going on maybe at the reference site. And the one thing we don't know about horny-head turbot in particular is we don't know their migratory patterns. We don't know their movements. We're trying to get funding for a tagging study to follow these guys. I've already talked to some people at Long Beach who do tagging studies, so now it's just a matter of getting the money to do it. It may be that that is the missing link here. But either way, there's still something going on with these fish. And okay, the next slide, if you have the PowerPoint, there's actually three different things that will come up in succession. If you have the PDF version, they're all up at the same time, and I'll explain those to you. This is the estrogenicity. This is the work from Dan Schlenk's lab at UC Riverside. And the plasma vitellogenin, what that should show, if you can see it clearly, is that 73% of the fish at the outfall, male fish, and this is horny-head turbot, which is the picture of the fish up there, are expressing vitellogenin. And, of course, vitellogenin males all have the capability of expressing all male vertebrates, but we should not be expressing vitellogenin in measurable levels. But 73% of the male fish are, and 83% of the male fish at the reference site are expressing. So again, there's something going on at that reference site or something going on with these fish. Now the concentrations, about 0.55 nanograms per gram at the outfall, 0.27 nanograms per gram at the reference. So the outfall is about double the reference in the expression, but the statistics show that there's no significant difference between sites. But statistics are only as good as the biology that goes into them. Personally, when I see double the amount at one site versus the other, I'm going to take a good hard look at it from an ecological perspective, and we are. Plasma estradiol, E2, the outfall, 389 picograms per milliliter, while the reference site has 330 picograms per milliliter. Again, no statistical difference. One-half GSI, gonadosomatic index. The outfall, the males, have a GSI of 0.076. The reference, 0.060. So it's slightly actually showing masculinization of these fish as far as GSI is concerned at the outfall, but there's no statistical difference between the two. Now, if you go to the next slide, you'll see what we did was we regressed estrogenicity or estradiol versus vitellogenin and sperm DNA damage. And E2 versus vitellogenin, the R-squared was 0.84, which for ecological data is very tight. It was statistically significant, and there were 17 degrees of freedom in there, so it's a fairly small sample size, but definitely tells us that something's going on there. And estradiol versus sperm DNA damage, the R-squared was 0.71, again, statistically significant, a very small set And we're going to do more of this work, or we have been doing more of this work. I just don't have the results to report on yet. But it definitely shows something's going on. Estradiol is definitely a major player out there. And so it gives us something to go on and something to continue to look at. The next slide gets into the sperm DNA damage, which I spoke on a little bit early than the previous slide. This was actually the first type of study that we did looking at biomarkers. We started it in 2000 and we went through 2004. We did the COMET assay, Scott Steinert's lab, the biomarker lab for Computer Sciences Corp in San Diego, did this work. And basically what a COMET assay is, for those of you who might not know, is you lyse the nuclear DNA, tends to be balled up, but if you have strand breaks due to stress or contaminants, then what's going to happen is when you electrophorese these on a gel, you get a ball mass of DNA, and then the strand breaks tail behind it. It looks like a comet. So, and the measure of the degree of DNA damage is the length of that tail. So it's called a comet assay. So the DNA damage is consistently greater at the outfall station over reference stations. And if you go to the next slide, which is a figure showing a graph of the 5 years of data that we have, you'll see that the outfall station is about twice the damage that the reference station does, although that varies from year to year. And if you look at 2004, the pattern is inversed. There's actually more at the reference than the outfall. The one thing about our reference station, T11, is it's very close to several offshore oil rigs. So this may be the result of maybe a shift in the currents and maybe PAH damage and exposure to these critters. But we haven't really teased all of that out yet. Now, the one question that gets raised with this tail moment, which is that length of the comet tail, is, okay, at what length are we saying this is deleterious? Is this a degradation? And that we really don't know. It's a great measurement. It's a great way of quantitatively showing that one site is different from another. But the populations aren't changing. The populations seem to be good year in and year out. So these are subpopulation level effects. We're seeing effects in individuals, but we have not seen population level effects yet, and we're happy about that. But we're also wanting to make sure we're even looking at the right thing. If you go to the next slide, this is something new that I added from the Las Vegas presentation. Dr. Julianne Coleman, she did her doctoral dissertation at UCLA on parasites, and she did her entire dissertation as part of the regional monitoring effort in 2003, the BIDO3 project, and where she looked at parasites in marine fishes from Point Conception down to the U.S.-Mexico border. But then we funded her to come in here as a grad student intern, and she looked specifically at our outfall, and also looked with Dr. Kelly at Cal State Long Beach at the effects of maybe endocrine disruption and parasites. So the question that she asked was, does parasitization affect fish stress and hormone levels? And the next slide just shows her poster child here, which is Scorpina guttata, the California scorpion fish. For those of you from the West Coast or familiar with West Coast fishing, this is commonly called a sculpin by fishermen, when it's actually not a member of the sculpin family at all. It's a rockfish. And it is venomous and kind of tricky to work with, but they're highly prone to parasites, as she found out. Almost 100% of these fish were parasitized, regardless of where she found them in Southern California, but did find that they were more highly parasitized at the major wastewater outfalls. So there's some indication that there is an outfall effect there. The next slide is coming up very slowly on my computer. But what it is a picture of the main parasite that these get, Neobranchia scorpinae. And what happens is these things are copepods that attach to the gill filaments of the fish. And in some cases, these fish will have 300 of these parasites hanging off of its gills, sucking on the blood that flowed through the gill membranes. And so, obviously, I would think if I had something attached to my lungs and sucking on my blood, I would definitely be stressed. And so it's likely that these fish are going to show stress levels and cortisol. So if you go to the next slide, what you see is the red bar is the number of parasites, and the blue bar is the average cortisol concentration. And if you look at the outfall, you see a lot of parasites, T1, a lot of parasitization, and very little cortisol, so they are chronically stressed. And then if you look at T11 to the left, the reference site, you have a lower amount of parasites, but a much higher cortisol surge, which is what you would think you would see. And then you go to T3, which is that downcoast station I pointed out on the map right at the beginning, 5.5 kilometers away from the outfall, and yet it's very comparable to the outfall in both parasitization and in cortisol. So we don't really know what's going on there. This was a pilot project, a first look, but we think it's very interesting. One of the things, the obvious questions is, okay, well, is this contaminants of emerging concern, or is it legacy contaminants? We have DDT all over the place. We should see that at the reference site if that were the case. Or is it just conventional contaminants coming out of the outfall, metals and other organics? We don't know. We're looking for funding now to continue this project to tease those questions out. But what we do know is these fish consistently show a greater degree of paratization at the wastewater outfalls in Southern California. And it makes an interesting side study to the things we've been doing. And it may tie in to contaminants of emerging concern. Julie is now a postdoctoral researcher in Dr. Kelly's lab at Long Beach, and a lecturer there as well. And so we're going to continue close ties since we're just right up the road and continue these projects with her in the future. And the next slide. Okay, so the conclusions of what we've done to date. We know there's indications of feminization. There's increased vitellogenin in males in both species, and there's increased sperm DNA damage in a horny head turbot, but there's also indications of masculinization. The GSI in the male of both species is greater at the outfall than it is at the reference. So, you have one hand and the other hand both going up at the same time. And there's higher proportions of male horny head turbots consistently throughout the years. We have almost 40 years of data, and it's about a 60-40 ratio of males to females. And the population structure looks fine. It doesn't change significantly from year to year. It has its normal variability, but it is normal variability. So we do not see population-level effects, at least in the fish that we have studied to date. And stress and growth hormone production is inhibited at the outfall, and we're going to continue to look into that. The next slide kind of puts these into context for our agency. The previous conclusions were more scientific. Flatfish in OCSD monitoring area, we show evidence of EDC exposure in our monitoring area. I have to assume it's coming from our pipe. No population level effects observed. Okay, but that's in the fish that we've studied. And are there other effects that we're just not looking at because we don't know yet? That's one of the things I like working with Kevin Kelly at Long Beach, looking at thyroid function and other things that we're starting to look at, because these chemicals, EDCs and others, affect more than just, there's more than just estrogenicity. And so we want to make sure we're looking at the right biomarkers. Definitive cause-effect studies needed linking these things, okay? And we're starting to work on that in a larger study that I'll speak to in just a minute. But that is definitely missing. And then for some fish species, parasites are definitely more common on them, and they're influenced by the outfall, they appear to be. And Julie and her grad students for years to come will be working on that. And the next slide, studies in progress. Estrogenicity source ID, there's a doctoral student who should be finishing her dissertation in June, Marianne Rempel at UC Riverside. She is addressing that to some degree in her study. correlation of EDCs and fish tissues to POTW. That is, that's a Sea Grant funded project that we just started, working with Cal State Long Beach and City of LA Hyperion, their environmental monitoring division. That's a 2-year project, and we don't have any results to report on yet. Cortisol inhibition and fish periodization, we're doing that with the Kelly Lab at Long Beach, and we'll be continuing those. We're looking for more funding for that, although we are funding, as an agency, we're funding some of that the research as well. And then endocrine disruption in coastal flatfish, which is the working title of a much larger project that a lot of these other things are being rolled into, which is being coordinated through SCWRP, the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project. It involves Orange County, L.A. County Sanitation Districts, L.A. City, Hyperion, EMD, City of San Diego, UC Riverside, the Schlenk Lab, Kelly Lab at Long Beach, and Dr. Michael Baker at UC San Diego, where we have developed a microarray using flatfish for the hornyhead turbot, looking for the expression of a whole suite of chemicals and biomarkers. We're also testing effluent, we're testing the water, we're testing the sediments, we're testing fish. And this is a 3-year project, and which began in July. Again, nothing to report back on yet. We'll have updates as they come up. But that's going to be a much more comprehensive project, and that's where we really get into the more definitive cause effects as we get into the later stages of that project, years 2 and 3. And next slide. Again, I just want to acknowledge the people who are actually doing the hardcore work on this. And that's Dr. Kevin Kelly, Dr. Julianne Coleman, Jesus Reyes, who is no longer a student. He got his master's degree in June, and he is now a researcher in Dr. Kelly's lab. Kathy Sack, the laboratory technician there. UC Riverside, Dr. Dan Schlenk. Dr. Luke Roy, he was a master's student at UCR when we started all this. He just got his doctorate at Auburn University. And Marianne Irwin Rimple, who will be getting her PhD in June, and Scott Steinert at Computer Sciences Corp in San Diego. They've been great to work with. They've really done all the hardcore work on this. We've just provided the vessel time and some ecological perspective on this whole thing. And next slide. And with that, I'll take any questions if there's time. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff, for keeping us on track. I wanted to apologize for the delay audio. With that, I'd like to open up the question and answer session. What I'll do is I'll take a question from the telephone audience, and I'll switch to the simulcast system. Please feel free to provide comments to give the audience further contacts or information on this topic. Share as many of the recent comments as possible. If all the time is filled up with questions, please post as much resource information as you can on the additional page. I'd also like to remind everyone that if you aren't able to get your questions now, don't hesitate to email our speakers. Find the speaker's email addresses on the main webinar page. With that, I'd like to take a question from my telephone audience.
This is Gordon Innes with the California State Water Resources Control Board. I imagine when these turbos are captured, there's a fair amount of stress that's placed on the fish. Does that affect the cortisol level?
Oh, absolutely. That is, and we want actually to see that stress expression. When these guys are captured, they're rolled, they're sitting on the bottom all happy, the net rolls over them, they jump into the net, they're rolled around, pressed up against a lot of other fish, brought on board, put into a holding tank, and then put into a bucket, and then finally weighed and measured, and it's after that that we take the blood sample to measure the cortisol level. So they're good and stressed. But we really want that because we want to make sure that if they're going to express cortisol from the stress, that they're good in stress, so if we don't see the cortisol expression, we know that it really is being inhibited. But yes, they're definitely stressed.
I'm going to read a question from our computer participant. Clarify why reference sites always be expected to have higher cortisol. Seems like it should have less than an area of stressor relief. This is from Betsy Cooper, King County, Seattle.
Okay, Angela, you were cutting out, I think. Correct me. The question is, is there a better area to use than the reference site we're using because it appears to be having a lot of stress on the fish itself? Is that basically what it is?
Well, the specific question is clarify why reference sites would always be expected to have higher cortisol. Seems like it should have less than an area of stress or relief.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, no, maybe I didn't explain the whole cortisol expression very well. What happens is you have a basal level of cortisol all the time when you're just happy and sitting down or whatever, and then when you get stressed, what your body does is it creates a bunch of cortisol. You get a big cortisol surge to help fight the stress that you are now confronted with. The problem is when you are constantly stressed, your body eventually shuts down cortisol production to a very low level because it just can't keep up with the constant stress. So you would find that in a fish that is in an area, I'll just pick, say, our outfall where there's contaminants coming out and whatnot, it's going to be constantly exposed to stressors. So eventually the cortisol production is going to go down. So a happy fish, a normal healthy fish, when we pull it up in a net and expose it to all those stressors, we should see a big cortisol surge. And we would expect a stressed fish to have a much less cortisol concentration. So that's why the reference fish will have a higher cortisol level. I hope that answers that.
Okay. Now let's switch back to our telephone participant.
This is Doris Valerius with the Sierra Club. How is masculinization biologically expressed? I know about the vitiligen with feminization, but what do you see?
In our case, what we're seeing is an increase in the size of the male gonad over from one side over the other. There are other expressions in other fish that we have not seen, but if you look in the literature, there are some female fish in certain areas exposed to certain masculinizing chemicals that are no longer producing eggs. They're not functional males, but they're not functional females either. But in our case, we're measuring that as an increase in the gonadosomatic index. Which, again, was not statistically significant between the outfall and the reference, but the difference between outfall and reference in my mind was big enough that it makes me look at it anyway, and it deserves further look.
Thanks.
Okay.
And now we'll switch back to our web participants. Tertiary treatment at a POTW impact on cortisol expression differently than secondary treatment?
In cortisol, I am absolutely not sure. Because we don't do tertiary treatment, and so the studies that we have done on cortisol with Kevin Kelly, we haven't measured that. So I don't have an answer for you. I'd have to look that up in the literature. That's a very interesting question. I do know that for estrogenicity and feminizing compounds, tertiary treatment in some cases does lessen that because microfiltration or reverse osmosis will tend to get a lot of these large compounds out, and so the effects of estrogenicity do go down. But the literature also shows that that's very site-specific to individual treatment plants because there's a lot that goes into it. But to answer just the cortisol, I really don't know. However, if you email me, I'll check my literature and see if there's something that I just haven't seen in there, because that is an interesting question.
Do we have any more home participants wanting to raise a question? Well, this is from the web. It says, this is part statement, part question. Great to hear there are a number of research projects that are, I apologize, my screen updates every 30 seconds. Place, I lose my place. It's great to hear that there are a number of research projects that are coordinated and in progress. Wondering if there's coordination, not just with California, but also coordinating with other researchers looking into similar scientific questions, so it's a more systematic research. This is from Chin Wen, EPA OPPP.
You know, to my knowledge, I'm assuming you're referring to maybe something like us out here coordinating with Boston or maybe up with Seattle or someplace like that. To my knowledge, no, most of the projects have been regional. Our larger project that I talked about, the one with all of the major POTWs and two universities or three universities and coordinated through SCORP down here that we're just beginning, those are the major agencies, but we're also, we have other people involved, like Southern Nevada Water Authority is doing the chemistry, water chemistry, effluent chemistry for us, and there are other parties involved with this that we're contracting with, but a large-scale, like multi-state coordinated effort I'm not aware of. No, and to be quite honest, it's been taxing enough trying to do it within a region. I'm not sure what the efficacy is of actually trying a multi-state or multi-region project. Maybe that's something that could be done in the future or looked at in the future. But a lot of these effects are also regional or site-specific. And what works out here and what we find, the results we find here, may not be applicable to Puget Sound or Florida or some other place like that.
Okay, well, thanks. Does anyone have any would like to answer a question from the phone? If not, this will be our last question. Question is, Turbot has comparatively lower cortisol level compared to English sole. Does it have anything to do with their body weight, shape or size?
No, we haven't done a quantitative assessment of that, but qualitatively these fish all have about the same length and body mass. I would be surprised. I think that it's likely due to feeding differences. Again, we haven't explored this fully yet, but just sort of my working hypothesis, they have different feeding types. There's some overlap, but the main prey items are different, and I think that maybe just the way they're being exposed dietarily to these compounds from their prey items that live in the sediments and above the sediments is different. I think that's part of it. Movement of the fish may be another part. Their movements inshore, offshore, and along shore. So there's a lot of things we have yet to discern, but I don't think that body mass is coming into play here. They're very similar in that sense.
I'll take one more from the web, and the question is, have you identified and studied other potential sources of EDCs, EPCPs, metals, etc., than the outfall, for example, shoreline sources? It looks like you may have many conflicting sources, and this is from updating, I'm sorry. Celine LaRousse, Capital Region District, Victoria, British Columbia, Canada.
Yes, we have, and that's part of the larger project that we're doing with the other POTWs. We're also looking at the inputs of rivers, storm drains, anything we can, we're trying to capture as much as we can in there because we do recognize that there are other inputs. From my agency's perspective, our initial look was, you know, what is our outfall doing? Are we an epicenter of disease and contamination? Are we causing destruction of fish populations? Well, the fish populations seem to be fine. We are seeing evidence of effect, or at least of exposure. We're continuing to look to make sure we don't become a problem, and we want to be a part of all these studies and find out, you know, what's really going on and what the concern is and maybe what the concern isn't. But that was our initial focus, and now we're starting to look at the bigger regional picture. And so, yes, we are looking at other inputs, and that they have to come into play in this. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Jeff, for your presentation. I'd like to wrap up this Q&A session. I apologize to those who for my voice cutting in and out, trying to maneuver between the speakerphone and the computer. I apologize for that. So now I'd like to introduce our second speaker of the day, Marcia Black from University of Georgia, and she'll be speaking on toxic effects from selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors on aquatic organisms. Marcia is a STAR, Science to Achieve Results, grantee. I'm her project officer. Her grant is closing. It has been a pleasure to be Marcia's project officer.
Okay, am I supposed to start now?
Well, let me pitch people. Quick reminder, please keep your phones on mute. To do that, that's *6. And to unmute is pound six. And please do not put us on hold because organizations have music or advertising. I want to tell everyone that Cynthia Nohel, my co-worker, this is a day from, you wouldn't believe, will be taking over. I have a family emergency, and I have to go. Marcia, I greatly apologize for this. Hope you have a great presentation.
Okay, thank you, Angela. Okay, so we're starting on slide 30. And please bear with me. This is my novice run of this type of a format, so hopefully it'll work out fine. But the outline of my talk is on slide 30. I am going to be talking about SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and we'll talk about the mechanism of action and talk a little bit about these chemicals, where they are, and at what concentrations they've been detected in the environment. And then our study objectives and results of the toxicity work, which was my part of the study. Dr. Kevin Armbrust of the Mississippi State Chemical Lab did all the chemistry and all the fate and transport work for this project, but I'll be only talking about the toxicity work today. And then I will try to summarize it and tell you where we're going from here. So moving on to slide 31. Oh, this is a... Okay. All right. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are drugs that are used primarily to treat clinical depression, obsessive compulsive panic disorders, PMS, and other types of behavioral and neurological problems. And the mechanism of action by which these drugs work is to block the serotonin reuptake by the neurons. And examples of these compounds are drugs such as fluoxetine, better known as Prozac, and also Seraphim, sertraline, citalopram, fluvoxamine, and paroxetine. And you're going to find, I'm going to start off talking about all of these drugs, and then we're going to narrow down to our studies primarily with Prozac. So moving on to slide 32, we have the structures of the serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And as you notice, these are very complex organic molecules. They came to our attention. Kevin is a pesticide chemist, and he noticed a number of similarities in functional groups and also in what he thought would be their chemical properties between pesticides that are very recalcitrant in the environment and very bioaccumulative in organisms and these structures. So that's one of the reasons that we focused in on these compounds. The other reason were some very provocative studies on mussels and clams done in the 90s by a researcher by the name of Fung, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. Slide 33 talks about how pharmaceuticals get into surface waters, and there are two primary routes. If you go down the right-hand part of that figure, when humans take pharmaceuticals, we assimilate them into our bodies, we metabolize them and excrete them into the sewer system or the septic tanks. These sewer systems make their way to wastewater treatment plants, which treat the chemicals. But wastewater treatment plants are pretty much not designed to handle chemicals. They're designed to handle solids and BOD and also bacteria. And so many chemicals pass through wastewater treatment plants in the very form that they entered them. On the left-hand part of the diagram are the other routes of pharmaceutical entry into surface waters through disposal, where we dispose of our pills either through the sewer system, then back to the wastewater treatment plant, or as pills into our trash, which goes to the landfill, which may have an opportunity to seep into groundwater and thus enter surface waters because all of these waters are connected. So several pathways for pharmaceuticals to get to surface waters, either in the form of the original compound or a metabolite that may be converted back to the original compound or may be more active than the original compound. Slide 34 talks, here we, several people have been involved in studies where SSRIs have been detected in the environment. Probably the one we've heard the most about and one that got a lot of the interest in pharmaceuticals as environmental pollutants was the Colpin study in 2002. And in that study, they looked at a number of rivers, surface waters that were downstream of sewage treatment plants, and they used some very broad extraction procedures and detected 0.012 parts per billion, subparts per billion levels of Prozac in the environment. Subsequent studies have detected larger amounts, higher concentrations in the environment. Metcalf et al. In 2003 detected 0.03 to 0.099 parts per billion, and then recently, and to my knowledge, this study is still unpublished, but in PrEP, my collaborators, Jean-Luc Kwan and Kevin Armbrust, have detected up to 0.076 parts per billion outside of Starkville, Mississippi. So clearly these compounds are making their way into the environment, and they're obviously stable enough in the environment, or they're contributed to the environment in a chronic fashion so that we can monitor them. We can pick them up through routine monitoring. And then in a study also in 2005, Brian Brooks from Baylor University detected fluoxetine, sertraline, and their metabolites in fish tissues. And these fish were captured below a sewage treatment plant near where he lives in Baylor, Texas. So, again, clear evidence that these compounds are landing in the environment and they have the potential to bioaccumulate in fish. Okay, slide 35. We have some data from Kevin and Jean showing some of the physicochemical properties of these chemicals that we've been studying. And if you look at, we have all five compounds, and we've looked at a marker of hydrophobicity, or the log KOW. And the low KOWs are a little bit lower than I would have anticipated, although the caveat to this is these are measured on the salt form rather than on the free base, and that would, if we had measured the free base, or if they'd measured the free base, then log KOWs would be much higher than the range of about 1.2 to 1.4. The log KOC tells a different story and tells probably a story that helps us realize how recalcitrant these things are in the environment. Log KOC is a measure of sorption to sediments and soils. And these are very high numbers for all of these compounds, ranging from 3.82 for fluvoxamine to 5.63 for citalopram. And what this says is these compounds will absorb to soil or sediments in a system where they can partition between water in these media. So that also tells us that they're going to be persistent in the environment, whether it be the aquatic environment and they're sorbed to sediments, or the terrestrial environment where they can be sorbed to soil. And then finally, photolysis tells us about the breakdown of these compounds by sunlight. And notice that fluoxetine is the most recalcitrant. It has the longest half-life, or the time it takes for half of the compound to be degraded. So if you zero in on fluoxetine, you see that it has a high capacity to sorb the soils and be persistent in both terrestrial and aquatic environment, and it's going to break down very, very slowly by photolysis compared to these other compounds that have faster breakdown times with photolysis. And Armbrust and Wook Kwan's research has pointed out that photolysis seems to be the major route of breakdown of these compounds in the environment. Okay, moving on to slide 36. So why do we worry about these pharmaceuticals? Well, first of all, they are designed to have an effect. They are designed to treat disease and to treat disease at the lowest possible concentration. So they're both potent and they're biologically active. So we know a lot about these through drug testing. We know what happens to mammalian species through drug testing. We know what happens to humans through clinical trials and also years of prescribing these. But we don't know a whole lot about what these drugs do to non-target organisms, especially those in the aquatic environment. Or those organisms in the aquatic environment, they are chronically exposed. They live, eat, breathe, breed, everything happens in the aquatic environment for most of these organisms. So they are exposed over generations and over their entire lifespan. So we don't know a whole lot about their environmental persistence and fate, although more data are being produced every day by scientists. But their chemistry does imply that these may be resistant to breakdown and also be persistent in the environment because of that. And then finally, those provocative studies about SSRIs, which showed that they promoted spawning in several species of clams and other mollusks. So that got us interested in SSRIs. So on slide 37, we have our overall research plan. And this was a two-phase study. We wanted to look at environmental state and degradation of these compounds, and then my part of the study, which I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk, are the acute and chronic effects to aquatic organisms. And we started off looking at an invertebrate, Ceriodaphnia dubia, and a live-bearing fish, Gambusia affinis, the western mosquito fish. And then as we moved into this project, we also added the African clawed frog, Xenopus laevis. So moving to slide 38. The first thing we did was, since there were no acute toxicity data on these compounds, we did those. We conducted acute toxicity tests with Ceriodaphnia dubia, the water flea, and we did 48-hour single compound exposures. Ultimately, we also did some binary and quaternary mixture exposures that I'm not going to talk about due to time limitations today. And in all of these tests, we use mortality as an endpoint. We also did chronic toxicity studies where we looked at a 7-day mini-chronic test and looked at brood size, number of broods as endpoints, and of course we followed EPA protocols in all of these studies. On slide 39, we have the results of our acute toxicity tests, so what we found was our most toxic compound was sertraline or Zoloft, and number two was Paxil or paroxetine, number three was fluoxetine, and the least toxic was Celexa or citalopram. Notice that these numbers are all in parts per billion, so we're ranging from 3,000 parts per billion for citalopram to the most toxic sertraline, 140 parts per billion. Now, if you recall those numbers for the environmentally relevant numbers, these are many-fold higher concentrations than those environmentally relevant numbers that were sub-parts per billion. So here we have 140 parts per billion for the most toxic So there's not much chance of acute toxicity of these compounds in the aquatic environment, at least to the water flea. And so moving on to chronic toxicity, slide 40. We looked at reproduction, as I said, so the total number of neonates produced over the 7-8 days, and also the number of broods produced over that time. And what we found here were, for our LOEC, or our lowest observable environmental concentration, or the lowest concentration of these compounds that cause an effect on reproduction, we saw significant decreases in the numbers of organisms produced for fluoxetine, paroxetine, and fluvoxamine, shown in the aqua color. And also those three also had significantly lower number of broods. So we're seeing an effect on reproduction, but we're still not seeing any effect anywhere close to those environmentally relevant concentrations. So on slide 41 talks about our studies with the mosquito fish, the western mosquito fish, Gambusia affinis, and for this organism, we did acute tests and chronic tests as well, and we wanted to look at both mortality, but also a little bit more sensitive indicator during both types of tests, and that is fish behavior. So move to slide 42, and we have the mortality data for the acute toxicity. We did 7-day studies in glass aquaria, and again, our LC50, our 7-day LC50, was 614 parts per billion. Once again, well above those environmental levels that would be causing us concern. But for our behavioral effects, we were observing these fish every day during this experiment, several times a day, and we determined that at 0.6 and at 6 parts per billion, getting a little closer to those environmentally relevant numbers, we saw significant behavioral effects. We saw uncoordinated swimming. The fish really couldn't right themselves. They were not in very much control of where they were going. If you rapped on the glass, they were not responding to that stimuli. Instead of swimming away, as most normal fish would be, they just kind of hung out, and they were hanging out at the surface of the water. And they were not interacting among each other, and that's pretty unusual for these fish as well when they're put together in a fairly small aquaria. So we feel that these behavioral effects may signal an endpoint that may be more sensitive, and it's certainly an environmentally relevant endpoint. So, and these were occurring at fairly low concentrations. The next study that we did was to do chronic exposures in outdoor mesocosm. So slide number 43 shows our experimental setup. We did these studies outside in this greenhouse depicted in the upper left, and the exposures were conducted in small plastic, or actually fairly large plastic tanks, 110-liter plastic tanks that were vented and shaded by the apparatus shown in the picture on the right so that the water temperature didn't get too terribly high. We put 50 young fish per tank. We had age-synchronized fish that we ordered from California, and we conducted an 85-day exposure of these fish where we changed the water one time a week, and we replaced the fluoxetine one time a week. So these are all, as I mentioned, we zero in on fluoxetine for these studies with the mosquito fish. So slide 44, here we talk about our results. After 140 days testing with these mosquito fish, that was the duration of the test, we wanted to look at a couple of different endpoints. We looked at time to reproductive maturity, and for male fish, this was indicated by a fully developed gonopodium. And we have a picture of a male fish on the left, and then also formation of the black spot, which is evident on the picture of the female fish on the right. And another thing we are still working on are the histological effects on gonads. I've cut about a zillion slides, and in still working on reading all of those slides and putting those data together. But if you go to slide number 45, then you see the results of the effect of fluoxetine on male sexual development. And what we're looking at here are the percent of male fish, male juvenile fish with gonopodia, with fully formed gonopodia, versus days of exposure. And if you look at the graph, the controls fish are in yellow, the 6 parts per billion exposure is in red, and the 60 part per billion exposure is in black. And we saw a significant reduction in the number of males with fully formed gonopodia after about 45 and 60 days exposure for the highest concentration of the 60 parts per billion. Once again, we're fairly high relative to the environmental concentration, but we did see that significant effect on a delay in male sexual development. If you move to the next slide, slide 46, we have the female data, and once again we're looking at the percent with black spot, that's our marker of sexual maturity, versus the days of exposure. And once again we see a significant reduction if you compare the controls in yellow to the 60 parts per billion exposure in black. We see a significant reduction in the number of fish with a black spot with fluoxetine exposure at 60 parts per billion. So we have some indicators that it is lengthening the time to sexual development. We don't really know how this plays out in terms of these fish being able to reproduce because we were never able to get these fish to finish reproducing in our experimental setup. The next experiment we did was with the African clawed frog. So turn to page 47. And the African clawed frog is a great organism to work with if you want to look at an aquatic vertebrate that is a little bit larger and in a different taxonomy, a different life history. And it's been used extensively. They're really easy to breed in the lab. You can take males and females and inject them both with human chorionic gonadotropin, put them in the dark overnight, and you will have hundreds of eggs to work with on the next day, so you can get a synchronized population to work with. And you always want to breed several pairs so that you don't have the offspring of just one pair of individuals. And these frogs develop from tadpole, once these eggs hatch, from tadpole to frog in about 60 to 70 days. So it's a reasonable time to do an exposure. And it's also a long enough time to see, to have some significant accumulation if the compound is one that will bioaccumulate, and also hopefully to see some effects. And there are a lot of measurable endpoints. Of course, mortality is one we always measure, but we wanted to look and see if there were any developmental malformations, and we also wanted to look at time to metamorphosis. And one of the reasons that we decided to study frogs was that thyroid hormone is one of the major, major hormones that is involved in cueing metamorphosis. Go to slide 48. And thyroid hormones, as I said, cue metamorphosis along with ACTH, but thyroid hormone is the major hormone that is involved in metamorphosis. And there's evidence in the literature that if you have tadpoles that don't have a thyroid, then you can inhibit metamorphosis. You can also expose tadpoles to chemicals such as perchlorate and reduce circulating T3 and also inhibit metamorphosis as well. And so we decided, since doing the literature research on fluoxetine and some of the human effects, we found that there was some indication in the human literature and also in the rodent literature that the thyroid axis was impacted by exposure to fluoxetine. So if you go to page 49, slide 49 rather, we have picture of the mammalian thyroid axis, and unfortunately we don't have this. My X's don't come and go as they should in a normal PowerPoint presentation, but the thyroid axis, you start with a hypothalamus that stimulates thyroid-releasing hormone, which stimulates the pituitary to produce thyroid-stimulating hormone, which stimulates the thyroid to produce T3 and T4. And what is in the literature is that serotonin inhibits the release of thyroid-releasing hormone from the hypothalamus in rats, and fluoxetine has also been shown to reduce circulating T3 and T4 and increase thyroid-stimulating hormones. So there are several different pathways in this mammalian thyroid axis where fluoxetine can inhibit the production of thyroid hormone. And as I mentioned, thyroid hormone is integral in cueing metamorphosis in amphibians. So we hypothesized that fluoxetine might impact or delay the metamorphosis of frogs that are exposed to fluoxetine. So, slide 50, there's our question, does fluoxetine inhibit frog metamorphosis? So we designed an experiment where we exposed tadpoles from hatch until metamorphosis at a number of different fluoxetine concentrations, including environmentally, the lowest concentration, which is environmentally relevant. We also used ammonium perchlorate, a known thyroid inhibitor, as a positive control at 10 parts per billion, or the same concentration that Goldman et al. Saw effects in the same species. And, of course, we had controls. And we observed these frogs during their entire development for limb development and timing to metamorphosis. And we've done this experiment three times now. The results from the pilot studies are on page 51, slide 51, where we saw significant developmental delays in these tadpoles after 57 days of exposure. And we saw delays in both forelimb formation and also tail resorption, and also an increased time to metamorphosis. But we also saw some mortality. So we redid the experiment a second time and got mortality within, or increased our numbers of tadpoles that we exposed, and got mortality under control in the second exposure. Data from that are on page 52, showing our different concentrations of fluoxetine on the x-axis, and the percent increase in time to metamorphosis on the y-axis. And at our highest concentration, we saw a significant increase in the time to metamorphosis at 29.5 parts per billion. Once again, we're 300 times greater than that 0.1 parts per billion, which is the highest environmental concentration that we have been able to find in the literature. Slide 53. Shows our data on masset metamorphosis, and this was a more significant effect that we found, and we saw a significant reduction in mass with every fluoxetine concentration that we tested, all the way down to 0.059, which is an environmentally relevant concentration. So what this is masset metamorphosis. What this means is these frogs are much smaller, up to 30 to 40% smaller than the controls when they undergo metamorphosis. A smaller frog is just going to be a whole lot more vulnerable in the environment than a larger frog. So these experiments, as I mentioned, are with the African clawed frog, Xenopus laevis, and this is an exotic frog. In the U.S., it does not occur naturally, and so we were interested in testing another frog that is native to the United States and certainly native to the Southeast where our laboratory is. So we got these data and decided, let's see if we can repeat this experiment with another species. So moving to slide 54, that species that we chose was the gray tree frog, Hyla chrysophilus. And this frog has a eastern distribution, just about the entire eastern United States, except for Florida and the very tip of Maine. And we chose it for several different reasons. First of all, it was easy to catch and it was abundant, and we could get them in, we could collect them in a location close to our lab that is a known pristine environment. So that was one of the reasons. The second was that we wanted to try a little bit different approach with this frog, and we wanted to see if we could observe another behavioral effect that is kind of a little marker for this frog. This frog will turn bright orange when it's exposed to a predator, and particularly on the tail, and what that is a defense mechanism drawing attention to the tail so that if something's going to get eaten or bitten, it's the tail and possibly the organs and the duty part of the tadpole can swim away and still survive. And so our notion was to do a kind of a two-point exposure. First of all, do a dose response to see if fluoxetine has similar effects on weight at metamorphosis, but also to integrate this behavioral change and this to test this predator response by this organism. So we had a second part of our exposure that involved predator exposure. And there's some evidence in the literature, as I said, that this bright orange coloration does occur under predatory stress, not only from an organism, but also from water taken from a tank where those organisms live and added to a tank with this Hyla chrysophilus in it. So on page, slide 55, we have our exposure methods. We collected egg masses from the field and started with tadpoles at Gosner stage 25 and followed them through metamorphosis, once again in single exposures in those 1 liter exposure chambers that are shown on that slide. We ran a number of different fluoxetine concentrations, but we were more interested in entirely environmentally relevant concentrations, or concentrations that were within a factor of 2 of that environmentally relevant upper limit. And then we also included a predator treatment, which was water from a dragonfly holding tank added to these exposure vessels. And so again, they're individually exposed in 1 liter of solution, and we did a static renewal of the solutions every week, and of course the tadpoles were fed as they always are in these experiments. So slide 56 tells us the endpoints that we measured. We looked at mortality, we looked at looked for malformations, time to forelimb emergence, time to completion of metamorphosis, and then mass and length at metamorphosis. And these guys undergo metamorphosis much quicker than Xenopus laevis. That was another reason to use this particular frog. So starting with slide 57, we have our data. And here we have our cumulative mortality of these tadpoles. For our controls, we had for our predator treatment about 15% mortality, and then about 8% for our controls with no predator, no added water from that dragonfly tank. And then we had about 15% and 30% mortality in the other treatments. And clearly these frogs are not quite as amenable to bringing into the lab and exposing in the lab as the Xenopus were. So we did have a little bit of mortality in these guys. Moving on to slide 58, we have, again, the showing predator and no predator treatments. The no predators in blue, the predators in red, and the mean time to metamorphosis versus concentration. And what we found was there was no effect on metamorphosis, time to metamorphosis, at the concentrations that we tested. In fact, we didn't see any differences in the predator response. We didn't see any differences in the time to metamorphosis, nor did we see any differences in the weight of these individuals once they underwent metamorphosis. They were, at all these concentrations, they were exactly the same. They were statistically the same as the control tadpoles, of the control frogs. So no effect at all at these concentrations of the fluoxetine. Had we used maybe a higher concentration just to have an upper boundary, we may have had a different answer. But again, we were aiming towards environmentally relevant concentrations or close to that with an environmentally relevant species. So move on to page slide 59. To wrap this part of the experiment up, we saw no significant effect of fluoxetine on Holocrysophilus. We saw no difference with or without the predator treatment. So maybe the tadpoles, our dragonflies had to consume more tadpoles than they did, and we saw very little consumption of tadpoles by these dragonflies. So that may have been necessary for us to get that fright response. So that was disappointing. And then the Holocrysophilus appeared to be less sensitive to fluoxetine than Xenopus laevis, since we did see the effects on the size or the mass of the tadpole at metamorphosis. So moving on to slide 60, our conclusions so far are, first of all, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are acutely toxic to Ceriodaphnia and mosquito fish. We can measure an LC50 for all of the compounds that we tested in both of those species. It will affect fish behavior at a lower concentration than we measure for mortality, or certainly lower than that LC50 concentration. It delays sexual development in fish at about 60 parts per billion, which is lower than the acute test data. And it also delays development and metamorphosis in Xenopus laevis, the frog model. But none of these effects occur at environmentally relevant concentrations. Moving on to slide 61, we did find one effect in our exposures that did occur at environmentally relevant concentrations, and that was the reduced mass. And so with chronic exposure to fluoxetine, Xenopus laevis showed reduced mass at metamorphosis, and that, we feel, is a significant result from these exposures. Move on to slide 62. The implications of the research are several. First of all, behavioral effects that we measure, lethargy in fish, if there were concentrations that high, and there were not, but they were higher concentrations than we would observe in the environment, but if this were to happen at more environmentally relevant concentrations, this would have a significant effect on fish populations. They're certainly more vulnerable to predation. They're certainly going to have less success in reproducing, and both of these together would result in a population decline. And we think the behavioral effects are certainly worthy of studying and worthy of pushing the boundaries down to lower and lower concentrations to see which behavioral effects might be better indicators of exposure or maybe not. Delayed development in fish and frogs could also have similar effects, certainly on predation. They're smaller. Certainly the frogs are smaller, and they're also delayed in their development. Increased predation, desiccation for frogs. Frogs, if they are not total obligatory aquatic organisms like the Xenopus, if they have to get out of the pond before it desiccates, then this a delay in development and metamorphosis could have significant effects on that population if that pond were dry up before they were ready to, they were metamorphosed. And then certainly the significant effect that we found, the reduced mass in frogs, certainly would lend itself to increased predation, decreased reproductive success, and possibly population declines. We also, in one experiment, found some limb malformations in our frogs. We've repeated that experiment, and one thing that was different in the repeat and the original experiment was that the temperature was much lower in the original experiment, and it was much longer time to metamorphosis of the controls. It just took much, much longer. So we think that the limb malformation in those data I did not show might be an artifact of that longer time to development, and certainly doesn't come into play under normal conditions out in the environment. So moving on to slide 63, these results certainly generate a number of questions that we hope to be able to answer in future experiments. Certainly we would like to conduct additional SSR exposures with Xenopus, and in fact we have just finished an exposure with Prozac and Zoloft in combination and as single contaminants. And those numbers are being crunched right now. We would like to be able to validate this apparent impact of fluoxetine on the thyroid axis, if that is indeed what is causing the smaller size and the reduced development of these organisms. And so we are, in this last experiment, also going to be measuring thyroid hormones at significant stages during the experiment and at the end of the experiment. Finally, it would be nice to know what the toxicity of mixtures of SSRIs in the amphibian model and in other animal models might be. These chemicals all behave and all exert their therapeutic action by the same mechanism of action, and so it would lead that possibly that they might have toxic effects or other non-target effects by similar mechanisms of action as well. So maybe those effects might be additive. So it certainly we should be looking at mixtures. And then finally, the big question are what is a real environmentally relevant SSRI concentration? And the chemists hopefully will be telling us that over time as they collect more and more data from their reconnaissance surveys. And slide number 64, I'd like to acknowledge the people that worked on this project. It certainly was a collaborative, collective effort. Ted Henry was a postdoc and did a lot of the acute. He did the Ceriodaphne work and all of the fish work. And Emily Rogers, who finished her master's degree and is now also at the University of Tennessee, did the frog work. Ben Hale, Nicole Campbell, and Tricia Smith also helped with the exposures and the numerous water changes and animal husbandry and everything that has to pull together to make these exposures work. As I mentioned, my co-PIs, Kevin Armbrust at Mississippi State Chemical Lab, did all the chemistry. He and Jung-Wook Kwon, his postdoc, he's now a research scientist there. And so they provided excellent analytical support, and they also did the fate and transport part of the project. And then finally, the people who gave us organisms and helped us with husbandry issues and such, Kay Miller at the U.S. EPA lab for her work with Ceriodaphne, and Jim Rayburn, Jacksonville State University, for his help with the Xenopus laevis. And finally, the biggest acknowledgement goes to EPA. This was a STAR grant, and certainly we thank EPA for funding this research. And as I mentioned, we are still crunching numbers from the last exposure. We hope to have a little bit more data and maybe just a few more answers as to why some of these things are happening here in the next 6 months. And I think that is my last slide, and I'm ready for questions.
Thank you so much, Marcia. This is Cynthia. And why don't we go ahead and jump into questions? Is there someone on the phone lines that would like to take the first question? You gotta take it off mute. Okay, I'm not hearing. Somebody gotta say something? Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, now I can.
Okay, I am right over the phone. let me find our first question. every time this refreshes every 30 seconds, it goes back to the top of the screen.
Yes.
Have any idea of the relative contributions of different sources of contamination? Is it mainly from excretion, landfills, or flushing?
Okay, the conventional wisdom is that most of the contamination is from the sewage treatment plants. It's effluents for sewage treatment plants. Those are certainly higher concentrations, and they're more chronic inputs to the aquatic environment than our landfill sources or land-applied sources. Although, you know, one thing that we haven't looked at very much, and I'm starting to see some papers on this, is the use of sludge as a soil amendment. And sludge is where these contaminants, if they're going to partition in the wastewater treatment process, that's where they're going to go because of that high KOC. And so it will be interesting to see if somebody can do some sort of not a mass balance, but give us some indication about how much of these compounds are also coming off of sludges that are applied to soil.
And actually, that leads to another question here.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't the high affinity for soil and sediment reduce the agent's bioavailability?
Yes, it would, but what you've got to remember is that organisms are in water and there's that trace amount in water and they can bioaccumulate the compound as well from the water. So there's a partitioning process going on. Some of it's going to the soil, some of it's going to the organism, and the compound, because of its chemical properties, has an affinity to go to both reservoirs.
Is there anybody on the phone lines that would like to pose a question?
Nobody left.
Oh, I think so.
Hello. Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Suzanne Lazorko calling with Emerald Environmental. When you talk about environmentally significant concentrations, is that like the lowest concentration that you're actually seeing some sort of impact in these amphibians?
Well, when I talk about environmentally relevant concentrations, I'm talking about concentrations that have actually been measured in aquatic environments. And the highest of those concentrations that I've seen in the literature so far is about 0.1 parts per billion. And that does overlap the concentration that we saw the effects on the size at metamorphosis, the frog size or mass at metamorphosis.
Another question from the web. Did you have any hydrolysis studies on fluoxetine?
Ooh, yes. Kevin Armbrust has published, I don't think he's published any hydrolysis studies on fluoxetine, but I could be wrong. And I'm sorry, I do not have his papers in front of me, but if the person who wrote that question would like to email me, I would be happy to find that citation. I'm sure I could find it. If he's done it yet, and certainly refer her to him because he's the one who did those studies.
Thank you. Anybody else from the phone lines? Okay, I'm going to keep going through the questions over the internet.
Okay.
Something just jumped. Do you know if there is any particular contaminants for which you observed either the wrong seminar, sorry.
Answer that question.
Do you have any definitive information on the percent contributions of excretion versus disposal of pharmaceuticals?
Well, again, I would think it's excretion and the contribution from wastewater treatment plants that would be the highest amount, but to my knowledge, nobody has actually done any studies where they could look at a situation where they had a wastewater treatment plant and perhaps a landfill or a biosolids application site or whatever, and to look at maybe a mass balance between those routes. I haven't seen anything in the literature about that.
Okay, here's one more. Your 7-day exposure set up for Gambusia and it appears from the slide to be a static exposure. Did you measure the concentration at the beginning and end of the 7-day exposure in the behavioral effect concentration ranging from 0.6 to 6 parts per billion?
Yes, we did, and trying to remember what the renewal rate was over that 7-day exposure. I think we renewed it twice during that 7-day exposure, and we maintained our concentrations within 10% of nominal.
That one also said thanks for the presentation.
Oh, well, thank you. You're welcome.
Have you seen any data on any of these SSRIs in sediment concentrations?
Aside from some preliminary data from Kevin and John, no. I've not seen anything in the literature about sediment concentrations, but they have measured concentrations in sediment in Mississippi, I think. I think I recall them talking about that. And, again, this is their newest data, and they've not published this yet.
Thank you. Anybody else on the phone have a question?
Yes, I have one question. Is the excreted SSRI, are they generally in the form of the hydrochloride, or are they the free base?
They are often, they're either in the form of the parent compound, which is probably in an aqueous environment. It's an ionizable compound, so it goes between the hydrochloride and the free base. But also they're excreted as a glucuronide compound as well, or at least the literature would lead us to believe that. But as many compounds that are excreted as glucuronides, that glucuronide can be cleaved off by microbial action, both in wastewater treatment and also in the aquatic environment, leaving you with that compound that is in an ionizable form. So it's going to be in both parent and an ionized form.
I have a couple more questions here. I noticed you used plastic containers for testing tanks. Did you test the water for phthalates, known EBCs?
Good question. No, we didn't. We focused in on the disappearance of our compound in those tanks and got a handle on that so that we could change the water frequently enough to maintain a concentration, a desirable concentration, or to account for that decrease in concentration. Well, actually, we did both. Both accounting for that concentration, the disappearance, and changing water. But we did not look at phthalates. We did rinse, we washed, we soaked, we rinsed, we did everything we possibly could to maybe age those plastic containers to the greatest degree that we could before we used them, but there was no way around using them for the large fish tank exposures and for the tadpole exposures.
Thank you, Marcia. Any other questions from the phone line? I have one more question here.
Okay.
Don't the relatively low KOWs mean that bioaccumulation by organisms would be low?
Okay, once again, this is what the chemists are telling me. They measured the KOW in the hydrochloride, in the salt form of all these chemicals, and had they measured the free base, which I'm not sure why they did one over the other, that the KOW would have been more in line with the KOC. So, yes, a chemical with a low KOW of 1 to 1.5 would not have a very high bioaccumulation potential, but we also know from Brian Brooks's data that these compounds do accumulate in fish, and that's one thing we are doing in this latest tadpole exposure as well. We're measuring bioaccumulation in the tadpoles. So hopefully we'll have a better handle on that. But I think it's just an artifact of the way they did that original log KOW determination. And I think the log KOC, which is sufficiently high that you would predict bioconcentration from that number, because there's a nice correlation between KOC and KOW, or KOC and bioconcentration factor. I think that gives us a little bit better handle of bioaccumulation potential. But once again, we'll have some real data on that hopefully within the next month or two.
Thank you, Marcia. Are there any other questions over the phone line? Hearing none, I think we'll conclude this webinar. Before people go, I want to remind them that there's one more session in this PPCP series. It will be November 8th, and it will focus on stewardship activities. Chen Wen from EPA's Office of OPPT, I can't remember what it stands for, cover an EPA program to assist hospitals with their pharmaceutical waste, and Karen North from the city of Palo Alto, California, will provide highlights and lessons learned from a recent San Francisco Bay Area pharmaceutical take-back event. Thank you for coming. We hope you will join us for the remaining seminar. And don't forget that these webinar sessions are archived for future viewing. And a special thank you to Jeff and Marcia for sharing their research with us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Bye-bye, y'all.